Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted October 20th, 2017, we feature a major story in the new WPJ fall issue, how England's minimum wage requirement to sponsor an immigrant divides refugee families, blocks love and marriage for many young Britons, and threatens a possible brain drain. We'll also spotlight other top stories in that new issue, Coverline Constructing Family. You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this.
Overall, immigration has been good for the UK, but what people want to see is control of that immigration. And we continue to believe as a government that it's important to have net migration at sustainable levels. We believe that to be the tens of thousands because of the impact particularly it has on people at the lower end of the income scale.
British Prime Minister Theresa May last month continued to defend the crackdown on immigration she launched 5 years ago as Home Secretary, now looking to add post-Brexit controls on EU citizens, as well as those from outside the continent. Her goal of about 100,000 is more than twice as generous as the 45,000 that U.S. President Donald Trump reportedly has in mind for 2018, but the UK has never gotten down nearly that far. And May's claimed concern for low-wage earners in the UK overlooked the painful impact of one particular aspect of that crackdown, her brainchild called the minimum income requirement, necessary to sponsor immigration of a family member, especially a spouse. The MIR has created a massive number of one-parent refugee families and prevented many young low-wage Britons, even a promising medical student, from marrying someone they met in Australia, the U.S., elsewhere, or online. British Somali journalist Ismail Inache, based in London, explores that contradiction and the consternation involved in the new fall issue of World Policy Journal. His article is headlined, Minimum Income Required, UK Migration Rules Put a Price on Family Unification. And we discussed it the other day for this podcast. Ismail Inache, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Thank you, David.
Tell us more about the rationale and politics of the conservative Liberal Democrat coalition in 2012 that led to the start of May's crackdown on immigration and especially the MIR.
Well, the minimum income requirement was brought into UK immigration rule changes in 2012. And that's when the government was in a coalition between the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats. And the kind of context to all of this was the attempt by the Conservative Party, which had for some years, since at least 2009, been committed to bringing overall migration down to the UK.
What are the minimum income requirements for bringing in a spouse, a child, or another family member?
British citizens and UK residents must prove they earn a minimum annual salary of £18,600. That's about $24,000 before they can bring in a spouse from countries outside the European Economic Area. Now, this figure increases by £3,800, or about $4,900, to sponsor a first child, and an additional £2,400, or $3,100, for each additional offspring.
And how do those requirements compare with average incomes around the country and the national living wage that was introduced last year?
According to figures from the UK tax offices, roughly 37% of earners have an annual salary below the minimum income requirement benchmark of £18,600 or $24,000 a year. So nearly almost half of adults who pay taxes in the UK earn less than the minimum income requirement.
The British government itself has confirmed how far-reaching the impact of MIR can be. A report by the Office of the Children's Commissioner for England. What did it say?
The report says that the consequence has been far-reaching for children who live in one of these families where one parent is a British citizen or a resident living in the UK and the other parent is normally outside the European Economic Area. But because of the changes brought in 2012, now this minimum income requirement has effectively split up families across borders and it's effectively split children from parents, husbands from wives, and grandparents from their grandchildren. And according to the commissioner, a report published in 2015 says that potentially up to 15,000 children who are British in the UK are impacted by these changes.
Give us the case history that leads your piece. A little boy who hasn't seen his father for 3 years and his mother who can't seem to earn anything near the required minimum. What does each of them have to say about the pain and the prejudice that they see involved?
Well, one of the stories that I cover in the piece is the story of Mahado. Now, Mahado is a British citizen, but she was born in Somalia and she arrived in the UK as a teenage refugee. And now she lives in a part of London, which is sort of high density poverty. It's full of housing projects. And she has two young children. And Mustafa, her eldest, is a boy. And she deals with the issue of having a child who's about 5 years old, who's going to school every day. And the boy asks his mother every morning when they go to school, he says, "Where is my father?" This is a question that she told me her son Mustafa repeatedly puts to her. And now she's not answering this question because she doesn't want to tell him that the reason why she can't, they can't be together as a family is because the government doesn't think that she earns enough. And she works part-time, 3 days a week, in London at a beauty store. She can't take up any more hours because she's got children, and she doesn't really have any realistic prospect of increasing her income. So for now, her family remains divided.
Well, I know you're right that they see it as a sort of prejudice against Africans, against people with darker skins, but you note that any low-income earner who falls in love with a foreigner could be affected. Tell us about the plight of a 28-year-old British comic named Liam.
Well, just before I mention Liam, perhaps, just to pick up on that point about who is impacted by these changes. And the research done by the Children's Commissioner for England shows that disproportionately the people who are impacted by the rule changes brought in 2012 and the minimum income requirement are low-income earners, but they also tend to be people from the poorer regions of the UK. So, for example, people from Northern Ireland, people from Wales, people from parts of England, and they also tend to be women and people who are ethnic minority. So when Mohado told me that she feels that she's unfairly treated by this, it's not just based on her personal observation, but it's also data and research which shows that this policy does adversely impact on people like her. Now, Liam is a young comic who lives in Edinburgh, and he is British born, and until the until he decided to get married to his Australian now wife, he wasn't really, you know, had to sort of face the immigration system like Mahado, who had come from Somalia. So he was pretty shocked that when he decided to get married, because he fell in love with an Australian girl, that he couldn't get married because he did not earn the threshold required for you to bring in somebody to the UK.
And it's not only working-class Britons who may feel the pain. Tell us about Paul McMillan, a trainee doctor at Glasgow University.
Right, absolutely. So it's not just the kind of low-income earners, it's not just people who are ethnic minorities, but it's actually also young, you know, would-be professionals. So Paul is an interesting case because he is a trainee doctor in Glasgow, and he, some years back, met his American now fiancé during a Camp America summer program they were doing together. They fell in love. His partner, she is a qualified social worker, and he wants to bring his partner into the UK, but unfortunately he does not earn the minimum income requirement. And this effectively has meant that when Paul finishes his studies in Edinburgh, he feels that he has no choice but to leave the UK because he's unable to bring his American partner. And just quickly, one thing he said to me, which is striking for somebody as a junior sort of trainee doctor who we require in the UK, because we have a big shortage of medical professionals like doctors, he said to me, "It's shaming to be British right now." He felt this was a stain on Britain, that he, somebody who can give back, who we as taxpayers in the UK, we give financing to young people like him to be trained as doctors, but when he graduates. He feels he has no choice but to leave the UK and possibly go and live in the US with his partner.
Macmillan's local member of parliament actually took his case to that chamber with a warning the law could lead to a brain drain for Britain. Say more.
Absolutely, and I think this is the reality and the unintended consequence of this minimum income requirement. When policymakers were thinking about this in the Home Office, which, by the way, doesn't have a good track record of implementing these kinds of changes, clearly there was little thought given to the kind of impact that this would have. The focus then, as it seems now, was to cut net migration. But the reality is that the consequence has been disastrous for the British Somali refugee to, you know, Liam, the young British comic, to someone like Paul, who's from middle-class background, who's a professional, who will be an asset in the future, and who, by the way, the UK government is training him. The UK government is paying for his education. Yet the unintended consequence of this policy has not been only to divide families across continents, but it's also effectively, as Paul's MP argued in the House of Parliament, lead to a brain drain of top kind of would-be professional talent in Britain.
Was there any consensus among British immigration experts and economists about the larger impact of May's goal of just 100,000 from outside the EU?
Well, the Conservative Party has since 2009 touted this idea of a net migration target as a benchmark in terms of cracking down or trying to bring the overall numbers of migrants into the UK down. Now, this has been viewed by analysts, by academics and others, merely as a political exercise. It's sort of a gimmick, really, because the government has consistently failed to meet its net immigration target. To date, this government, led by Theresa May, under the Conservatives in a minority government at the moment, they have yet to, since the Conservatives came into power in 2010, they have yet to meet their net migration target. And it's come for heavy criticism by policymakers. For example, someone I mentioned in the piece I wrote is Jonathan Porteous, who's a professor of economics and public policy at King's College in London. And just to give you a note from the piece, he wrote a piece in the New Statesman in April, which is a left-leaning publication, and he says this. Essentially, he says to describe the net migration targets, he says, essentially scribbled on the back of an envelope with no serious analysis of either its feasibility or desirability, this target has distorted UK immigration policy since 2010. From either an economic or social point of view, it's almost impossible to justify it.
How close has the country ever come to 100,000?
Well, the numbers, for example, show that there was a dip. So net migration dipped in the first few years of this decade from 256,000 in 2010 to 177,000 in 2012. But it's increased since in the following years. And at the moment, records from the government, 12-month period ending in March this year, shown that migration to be about 246,000. And some of that fall is based down to the departure of EU citizens who've left the UK since Britain voted to leave the European Union in June last year.
You note that the figures released by the government also reveal that it had been overstating at least one alleged category of immigration law violation involving students. Say more about that.
Home Office has, for years, it's now has come to light this summer, been overstating the number of international students who overstayed their visas, which, in short, you know, undermines, you know, the Conservatives' whole agenda, which was to try and bring net migration down to the tens of thousands of people. And a linchpin of that policy was this, you know, figure that there had been I think potentially 100,000 people who had potentially, who were students who were overstaying on their visas. Now we know that number was wrong by, I think, something like a margin of 96%. That actually the true figure is actually about 4,600. And you have to think about this policy, you know, in the context of the political climate in Britain, where migration has become a very toxic issue for many years now. And this pledge that the Conservatives have, you know, unilaterally made to cut down migration to tens of thousands was always underpinned by this idea that there were all these students who would come into the UK to study and they were overstaying. And then finally we found out this summer that that was not the case. And subsequently, the Office of National Statistics, the UK's official statistics agency, has now launched an independent inquiry to look into how this could have happened, how we could have been so misled on such a big scale in terms of such critical numbers which set government migration strategy and policies.
Will Brexit, if or when it happens, mean that EU citizens will soon come under that same 100,000 cap or the various measures of regulation for dissuading them to come to the UK?
Well, I think initially there was talk of European Union citizens, once Britain leaves the European Union, and whatever arrangement the UK reaches with the European Union at that point, the EU citizens who now are not part of the requirement, which is required of those people who are outside the European Union to basically meet this net, to meet this minimum income requirement. There was some talk saying that perhaps EU citizens would have to face the minimum income requirement. I'm hearing at the moment that that's not going to happen, but at this stage, the UK has been through an epic sort of journey since June 2016, since the UK voted to leave the European Union. And at this stage, we haven't got any clarity, really, on the long-term relationship when it comes to migration rules between the EU and between the UK. And we can't be certain how that kind of relationship may look like in the future. One thing that has happened as a consequence of Brexit, though, is that increasing numbers of EU citizens who are currently resident in the UK, perhaps worried about their status, are choosing to leave. So the numbers are decreasing. That doesn't mean, though, that the government will be any closer to meeting its net migration target even after we leave the European Union in 2019.
What do public opinion polls say about support for the current immigration regulations and not getting into the post-Brexit phase and belief
right.
that the government can really enforce them?
Well, I think there's general support for bringing down migration numbers in Britain. I think there has been a growing public sentiment even before the Conservative Liberal coalition from 2010 and the Conservative majority from 2015 under David Cameron, and now even with this Conservative minority government. Even before that, under the Labour Party, for many years really, for the last 15 years I'd say, migration has become an enormously important issue, not just in Britain, of course, but across the West world and across the European Union. The issue is that most people in the UK, because there have been so many scandals over the years, I think there's a healthy dose of kind of skepticism. And there's quite a lot of cynicism about the effectiveness of the UK border agency or the Home Office to manage the UK's borders. And the borders was a big theme of Brexit, of course. And when it comes to the net migration target, there is probably general support. There have been polls to show that most people support these kinds of policies. But actually, according to an Ipsos poll released in May, 68% of those surveyed said they didn't think the Conservatives could meet their target of 100,000. So while people support the government's efforts to cut down on migration, and people are skeptical, but people remain skeptical of their capacity to actually implement measures to tackle migration, to bring it down to tens of thousands as they state their goal to be.
How does that contradictory public opinion, the threat of a brain drain, other economic factors, how is all of that likely to shape parliamentary action going forward?
Well, I think at the moment, the whole process of governing in the UK is sort of grind to a halt. Brexit dominates everything. And there are divisions currently within the Conservative Party. Just right now, this week, is the Conservative Party conference in Manchester in England. Last week, we had the Labour Party conference. Theresa May, who's the current Prime Minister, she is under enormous strain. And I think it's unlikely, for example, for people like Mojado, who still remains in a divided family. Her husband still is in Dubai and her children are here with her in London. Someone like her will unfortunately have no real short-term solution to their problem. And in terms of the parliamentary process, I don't think we're going to see any major shifts on migration. And the government ought to abandon this net migration target. Many experts have sort of pushed that. But at the moment, there's a kind of over-focus on Brexit, and that's what's dominating the government's agenda.
In the absence of enough political pressure to end the MIR policy, you say some activists are going to court against it. Say more about that.
See, in terms of the minimum income requirement, the avenue that activists and indeed families impacted by this law have tried to make changes through taking legal action. And there was quite a big case in February of this year. The UK Supreme Court heard a case which involved three people, so two British citizens and one refugee from Lebanon, who had been unable to bring in their spouses to live with them because of the income threshold. The judges ruled, though, in February that though they recognized that the minimum income requirement had brought harsh conditions for thousands of couples and some of their children, that still, in principle, they accepted that it was legal and that the government could continue with enforcing its minimum income requirement, which for now is the case. And the Home Office subsequently said that the minimum income requirement still remains a central tenet of building an immigration system that works, as they say, in the national interest. So even the legal avenue has been attempted, activists still continue with the support of NGOs and others in the UK to continue to try and seek a legal route to getting rid of the minimum income requirement. But at least for now, the policy remains in place.
Ismail Inashe, thank you.
Thank you.
Ismail Inashe is a British-Somali journalist based in London, an Ochberg Fellow at the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. He's also an associate at the Cambridge University Migration Research Network. Also featured in the new WPJ Fall issue, you'll find articles about defending families from terrorist recruitment, about rape and priestly power in Nicaragua, and about the Trump effect on gay rights in Liberia. And listen next week when our podcast will focus on the dark side of global lottery empires. World Policy on Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Interim editor Jessica Laudis, managing editor Laurel Jerombeck, podcast producer Isabel Vasquez. I'm David Alpern.